My name is Olga Morales-Pate. I am the CEO at Rural Community Assistance Partnership, RCAP, and you are listening to the Water Values Podcast.
The Water Values Podcast is sponsored by the following market-leading companies and organizations: by 1898 & Co., Possibilities Powered by Experience; by Woodard & Curran, high-quality consulting engineering, science, and operations services; by Intera, innovation and stewardship for a sustainable tomorrow; by Xylem, let's solve water; by the American Water Works Association, dedicated to the world's most important resource; by Black & Veatch, building a world of difference; and by 120 Water, new rules need new tools. This is session 255.
Welcome to the Water Values Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to water utilities, resources, treatment, reuse, and all things water. Now here's your host, Dave McGibson.
Hello and welcome to another session of the Water Values Podcast. As my daughter Sarah said, my name is Dave McGimsey and thank you for joining me and thank you for your support for over the last 10 plus years now. We have a terrific and important show for you today. We're welcoming Alan Townsend, a Senior Program Officer on World Wildlife Fund's Freshwater and Food Team. Alan focuses on freshwater metrics and stewardship, and in that vein, Alan's here to discuss his work on corporate water stewardship and science-based targets for nature. We had a terrific discussion, and you'll really enjoy hearing about some of the initiatives Alan is pushing forward on. He is a fantastic guest. Well, as you know, we always say thank you to our awesome sponsors at the top of every show. Our 2024 sponsorship lineup includes 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, Xylem, the American Water Works Association, Black & Veatch, and 120 Water. And that, my friends, is a terrific collection of impactful companies and organizations that have affirmatively decided to support water industry thought leadership and education, and I thank you all. And I'd like for you, the listener, to do me a favor, if you would, please, if you work for or with any of those sponsors, please thank your boss or thank your contact at the sponsor firm and let them know that you appreciate their leadership in the industry through the sponsorship. You'd be surprised how far that simple little note of thanks would go. And hey, as long as you're letting the sponsors know that you appreciate their support of water industry education and thought leadership, why not leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whatever other podcast directory you're accessing the podcast on? It'd be greatly appreciated and will help others find out about the podcast. And also, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Yes, that's kind of important too. Well, before we head on to the interview with WWF's Alan Townsend, we've got a Bluefield on Tap segment with Bluefield Research's Reese Tisdale talking about the IIJ funding rollout. So take it away, guys. Reese, welcome back to another Bluefield on Tap. How you doing?
Pretty good, Dave. Pretty good. Just wrapping up what some people call spring break, what I call a work vacation. So happy to be here.
Awesome. Well, thanks for taking time out of your spring break slash work vacation. A lot going on in the water sector. So what's risen to the top of the stack this month?
Well, I think last time we spoke, we were just about to put out some research. We've gotten a lot of questions about IIJ and what is the status of IIJ funding. If you look at financial reports of publicly traded companies in the water sector, everybody talks about tailwinds and how strong the market is. And I think everybody's pretty busy. But then if you get closer to the projects, particularly when you start talking to contractors and those who are sort of putting shovels in the ground, the dollars don't seem to be there quite yet. So what we've done more recently is kind of taking a deep dive into the funding and where it is in the pipeline.
All right. So where did you discover the funding was in that pipeline?
Well, the way we looked at it was, I mean, everybody seems to focus, you know, for obvious reasons on within the water sector. IIJ in November 2021, one point, just walked down the pipe, $1.2 trillion. Of that, $550 billion was new, but 10% of that. So let's just say $55 billion of that was allocated to the water sector. So that's really what we focused on. There's some nuances to it, whether you're talking about state revolving funds, Western water funding. But is, let's just, you know, for all intents and purposes, $55 billion is a good number to go with. The funding, 85% of that goes to state revolving funds. So we're talking about $43 billion is in the state revolving fund. So that's really where a lot of our activity was focused on looking at. And what we did is we looked at from appropriation to announced to obligated to outlaid. And there's a huge difference when let's just say state revolving funds. So if you're looking at state revolving funds, $43 billion, we can only account for $1.8 billion being outlaid to date. And we're halfway through the IIJA life cycle.
Wow. So why do you think the rollout is so slow? Is it the infighting in DC that's kind of causing it? Is it high interest rates? I mean, what's driving the inability to press down on the accelerator?
Yeah, I mean, I think we at Bluefield, we feel that state revolving funds, it's established, it's the programs, the state programs, that's maybe the key word, state, being that every state has its own program, but within each you have clean water and drinking water. And they're all sort of run or operated somewhat differently. And so projects prioritize differently. So that in and of itself is a process. Some, quite honestly, are better than others in managing the process and are faster. So I think that's one aspect of it. I think another big part of it was or is that $25 billion was going to lead and PFAS. And part of that is if you don't know what the problem is, you can't really do anything about it. So a big part of this is sort of setting in sort of inventorying practices or programs to figure out where the problem is. That is picking up. But that being said, you can see why a number of contractors are saying, hey, where's the money? We're getting a little bit frustrated by this because that's pretty significant when you're talking about only 3% to 4% of the dollars have actually been outlaid.
Yeah. And what about the other bucket? So you indicated the one bucket was 1.2 or 1.8 billion.
1.8 billion.
1.8 billion. How are the other buckets faring?
So they're all pretty low. I mean, when you start looking at, it can range anywhere from 4 to 20%. We looked at 10 different programs as a whole. So what we did is we looked at everything from lead service lines to just the general supplemental accounts for clean water and drinking water. We also looked at water recycling and desalination. We looked at water storage and conveyance. And water smart grants as well. So those are just sort of sub programs within the water related IIJA funding. But as a whole, in aggregate, it's only about 6% total of all the dollars, including Western Water. So we're still got a ways to go. So I think that what it means going forward is there hopefully is a tsunami of funding that's going to actually hit the streets and support the shovels going into the ground. I think the engineers and designers are actually, they're kind of ahead of this. Some of these projects have been sort of in planning for some time. So they're probably doing okay. They've been paid out in some respects. But when it comes to shovels in the ground, we're a little bit behind. The other thing to think about is if we're halfway through the year, I hate to say this, we're in an election year. So what does that mean after the election? So we're starting to get questions about what is the any changes in the political parties, whether it be in Congress, the White House, what does that potentially mean? Not only for IIJA, but also what about IRA, which may be under greater threat, or other EPA-regulated programs, such as things like PFAS going forward?
Yeah. That is definitely a big question mark. And you had also indicated that, hey, you know, some state revolving funds are better than others at working the system, so to speak. Are there regions of the country that are seeing more investment than others, or is this just kind of a checkerboard effect?
It's kind of a mix. I mean, what we basically said or taken a look at is, you know, approximately 75% of the available state revolving funds for fiscal years 2022 and 2023, they've been contractually promised. So they have made their way through. But there are certain states that are definitely further ahead. There are about 16 states, you know, California, Pennsylvania, Michigan, New Jersey, Wisconsin, Indiana, which is where you are, Georgia, Massachusetts, South Carolina, Rhode Island. Those are all states that are further ahead as far as being obligated to funding. There's a wave of others that are behind. And in some cases, you know, I know in the case of some Pacific Northwest states, they've actually pushed back on PFAS funding because they're still trying to figure out what the policy is and what the programs are. So there are some delays in that. One thing that always comes up, Ohio always stands out to us when it comes to state revolving funds because they're very generous when it comes to awarding projects. If you meet certain criteria or their criteria, they will fund the projects, whereas other states in some cases underfund or don't take full advantage of state revolving funds.
Interesting. Yeah, you're right. We're lucky here in Indiana to have Jim McGough run the state revolving funds. He's phenomenal. Well, Reese, thank you so much for your time today. I know you want to get back and hit the slopes or play with the kids. So thanks so much. And we'll talk to you next month. Maybe we'll get a little baseball talk in.
Yeah, let's maybe do that. We'll see how we'll see how things wrap up spring training. I don't know if the Red Sox have much pitching to talk about. So look forward to it.
The Athletics said they might have a top five AL rotation, so we'll see.
All right, we'll see.
All right, we'll see you. Thanks, Reese.
Bye. Take care, Dave.
As always, great information from Bluefield Research and Reese Tisdale. Now it's time for the main event, our interview with WWF's Alan Townsend. So let's get that water flowing. Well, Alan, welcome to the Water Values Podcast. Great to have you on. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to our conversation, and thank you so much for coming on, Alan. Could you, for starters, give us a little thumbnail on your background and how you came to the water sector?
Sure. Yeah. So a lot had to fall into place, but I'd say chief among those was my experience as a engineer at Renewable Water Resources in Greenville, South Carolina. So in undergrad, my university, Clemson University, has a really fantastic co-op program. And at the time, I was still trying to figure out what my path is and where I was kind of heading with my career. And during, I think, the 20 or so interviews during to enter the program, really hit it off with the folks at REWA. And, you know, wastewater wasn't an area that was, you know, top of the list. I had several disciplines or engineering disciplines I was kind of considering at the time, but, you know, digging more into it, I was like, oh yeah, this space is really complex. It's fascinating. It's really relevant. And I had a really positive time during my experience there. And while I was in that or during that co-op rotations or during my co-op rotations, I read this book by Stephen Solomon about the water and the epic struggle for wealth, power, and civilization. And I think that book really opened my eyes to, how critical water is to society and, you know, the success or failures of civilizations. So I think for me, it just really kind of galvanized, you know, my interest in water and kind of staying on that path.
Got it. So with this interest in water, where did it lead you? What are you doing now in the water sector?
Yeah. So I'll spare you the many jobs and internships and experiences that I have. But, you know, right now I'm at World Wildlife Fund, WWF, here in the U.S., and I'm on the freshwater and food team. And my main role now is having the privilege of serving as the co-lead for Science-Based Target Network's Freshwater Hub, which I know we'll get into a little bit here. And so my experience has come from, obviously I have the engineering background and then drawing on that, as long as my water kind of governance and management experience. And then on the back end, I recently finished my PhD at University of Virginia, looking at how we can integrate behavioral science in our work in the environmental space. And so my role now really draws on a lot of different aspects of my experience, and it's been really exciting. I've been with WWF now almost 2 years now. The time's flown by, and enjoying the journey so far.
That is awesome, and congratulations on getting your PhD. One of the great things about hosting a podcast is I get to speak to all kinds of people who are smarter than me, and so I get to learn from folks like you. World Wildlife Fund. What could you kind of give us just a, you know, you mentioned you're in the food and water section of that. I think I messed that up, but
freshwater and food.
Okay,
you're almost there.
you can tell I'm hungry. I haven't eaten lunch yet. Could you kind of give a broader description of what WWF is? You're in the freshwater and food division. What are some of the other divisions? You know, what's the overall mission for WWF?
Yeah. So WWF is, obviously a large international, conservation organization, with footprint all over the world. I'm in the DC or the US office in DC, but, we have offices all over the world focusing, from everything from freshwater to ocean, forest, climate, plastics. And so we have a whole host of things that we focus on in terms of, you know, thinking about the environment and nature at large. So I think there's a lot of cross-cutting work among our teams. And so that's one of the appeals for me and joining WWF is the kind of the, you know, obviously I'm more in the freshwater side of things, but getting the opportunity to get exposure to various aspects of the space, and then being able to kind of play or and dabble in various other parts of the organization in terms of, and being able to kind of contribute to that work. So that, I think that like kind of captures what WWF does in a brief nutshell.
Perfect. That's great. Okay. So you're in the freshwater section. What kind of work does WWF do in the freshwater section?
Yeah. So WWF, you know, recognizes water is our lifeblood. So it's one of the most precious resources that, we have in the world, and it fuels everything from food that we eat to the cotton we wear and the energy that we depend on every day. And so the work that WWF has focuses on is trying to highlight those connections and, you know, bring awareness to that, but then also driving action, particularly in areas where it's needed most. And so one of the pressing challenges in the freshwater space and the environment more largely is the biodiversity crisis, and freshwater habitats is a big part of that. And WWF spends a lot of time, if you look at the freshwater team, trying to bend the curve on freshwater biodiversity. So how we do that is WWF partners with governments, businesses, international financial institutions, and communities to ensure healthy freshwater systems exist to conserve wildlife and provide a sustainable future for all. And so within that, we have a corporate water stewardship team. And we have folks across the org, the network that work on this. And one of the kind of critical or fundamental pieces of that is recognizing that, you know, businesses run on clean and abundant water. Most companies know that water will likely affect business growth and profitability in the near future. And so water is now recognized as a material risk, and stewardship is critical to long-term business growth. So one of the critical aspects of our work is the corporate water stewardship piece. And well, through our partnerships, we try to foster and encourage corporate partners to get on in the water stewardship journey and foster them along the way. And we describe water stewardship, there's, you know, a variety of definitions, but one that I particularly like is provides a paradigm of resource management and governance that calls on businesses, governments, and local communities to come together to define enduring solutions to our shared water challenges. And so there's been a lot of work in this space, a lot of folks that have influenced me in my career, just, you know, from as I kind of gone through the school and training and things like that. And it's been a real delight to be a part of that community now and contribute to the decades of work and research that has gone into this space.
Yeah, I think diving into corporate water stewardship would be, I would love to talk to you more about that. But what I really want to talk about today is the Science-Based Targets Network and the Freshwater Hub that you've been involved in. Can you explain what the Freshwater Hub is?
Yeah, so as members of the Science-Based Targets Network, a partner of the Freshwater Hub, WWF is collaborating with CDP, the Nature Conservancy, Pacific Institute, and World Resource Institute in providing technical expertise in the development of science-based targets for nature. And so the hub has been working for several years now to develop the guidance and refine it. And it's been a really fascinating and just really awesome group to be a part of to act in this, but I would say like a kind of pre-competitive nature to kind of develop this, the guidance here for companies.
Could you kind of give us a, you know, what is the Science-Based Targets Network and why is it important and how does it affect the Freshwater Hub?
Science-Based Targets for Nature is a coalition of over 80 environmental NGOs and mission-driven organizations that draws on the work of the world's leading scientists and experts to develop and promote the adoption of science-based targets for nature. WWF is one of the founding partners of SBTN, and you know, how I like to describe it is folks that might be more familiar with SBTI in the climate space. SBTN kind of serves as like this sister organization, although we're, you know, not formally connected, but an organization that focuses on nature to kind of complement the work for companies on climate. SBTN has developed a 5-step process that enables companies to set targets and act on nature. It takes an integrated approach across freshwater, land, ocean, and biodiversity, as well as climate, to help companies kind of comprehensively assess their impacts and dependencies on nature, then set targets on those. In step 4, lay out what are some of the actions companies can take against their targets. And then there's in step 5 track where companies can monitor, report, and have verification of their progress against their targets.
So Alan, when I initially asked, I said science-based targets for, you know, science-based targets network, and you kind of were talking about the science-based targets for nature. Could you identify the distinction between those two things?
Sure. Yeah. So science-based targets network is the organization that leads the development of the guidance and tools for the science-based target for nature guidance. And so the network is, just in brief, is the organization, and as science-based targets for nature is the framework or the guidance that supports that.
Perfect. That's exactly what I'm looking for. And so could you talk a little about the goals? Like, what are the science-based targets for nature trying to achieve?
Sure. Yeah. So the overarching goal is to promote a safe and just future. And so the targets, you know, depending on the realm, whether it be, you know, land or freshwater or ocean, are derived from thresholds. Within the freshwater component of SBTN, there's two types of targets. There's water quality and water quantity targets. And then there's also a dimension that looks at, you know, where are these pressures on nature. So whether it be on the direct operations or in a company's upstream value chain. For freshwater quantity, the nature of the targets are looking at water use. So looking at surface water and groundwater. Freshwater quality, the targets right now focus on nutrients, so phosphorus and nitrogen. And then as we look ahead, we are looking to kind of expand some of the scope of the targets, but we can talk about that here, I'm sure, in a second.
Yeah. So it sounds like these targets are, they're not set in stone, right? So if, for example, I'll just pull something out of the air, if PFAS, you know, that I could see that becoming a target at some point.
Yeah. So, PFAS is certainly something that we've received questions about. It's certainly something we're keeping an eye on. As we look ahead, I'm sure that'll be something that we, look at more closely in terms of understanding, you know, data availability on that particular contaminant, and then what are ways that, you know, companies can try and act on that? What are some of the solutions to, you know, in companies' kind of sphere of control to kind of tackle that? I think for some of these issues, particularly PFAS, it's something that obviously we're still continuing to learn more about. And also emphasize or just highlight that right now we're only focused on direct operations and upstream value chain. And as I'm sure you know, that I think some of the PFAS issues can maybe perhaps fall in the downstream parts of companies' value chain. But that's something we're keeping an eye on, and I'm sure more to come on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of who are some of the companies that are involved that you're able to disclose?
Yeah, so we have, there's kind of a couple of answers to this. One is right now we're actually running or wrapping up a pilot, what we call a target validation pilot, on the first three steps of the process. So Dave, I don't know how if I really laid this out yet, but so last May, version one of the guidance was released that included steps 1, 2, and 3, which is the target setting process of the three steps. And 17 companies are piloting that process right now, and their targets are getting validated. So just a few companies I'll name just offhand are Alpro, GSK, H&M, and Nestle. So there's, you know, a good variety of companies there. And we have obviously more information on our website about that. And another way that companies can get involved is SBTN's corporate engagement program. At last count, there's over 120 companies that are a part of it, of the program. The market cap is estimated to be over $4 trillion, and they have a presence in over 30 countries. And there's a lot of reasons to potentially engage in the program. I think one is to just be able to you know, garner insights in the process and having kind of an early look at, you know, what's coming up next, understanding various tools and components and having, you know, access with to the developers of the guidance. But also as a way to obviously, you know, be a part of the community that's, you know, setting targets and moving this work along. So there's, I think there's kind of like I said, two levels to the companies that are a part of this. And we have a list of the companies that are currently involved on our website.
For companies that are interested in learning more about it and, you know, what are some of the advantages for joining early? Why would a company want to get involved early rather than waiting?
Being an early adopter has a few advantages. So for us, this process has been quite iterative for us is like the Freshwater Hub and all the hubs and the method developers. So we've pilot tested this. We've gone through several consultations with experts and practitioners, and being a part of the process has really enhanced you know, the scientific rigor, but also the practicality of the guidance, and just bringing, you know, various perspectives and of various companies and sectors to this work. I think it also allows like companies to be able to kind of be aware and kind of start to you know, share this the information internally about the various parts of the guidance and the tools and have access to the folks that are fairly involved with the process. I think another part that I also see is, or another advantage or value add is that, you know, a lot of this work really rely on, you know, not just one company, but multiple companies and actors, you know, taking action on these targets. And so I see it as a way for, you know, encouraging cooperation and perhaps collaboration among companies, whether in the target setting process or, you know, looking ahead to implementation. And so there's a range of advantages of joining early and being a part of the process. I'll say that we have some early insights from the companies that have been a part of the pilot. You know, they've have found quite a bit of value in going through the target setting process, whether that be from a, you know, a competitive angle or risk-based angle. And so I think, you know, these insights have really helped us enhance how either we talk about this work, how we frame it, how we can enhance the guidance, or, you know, make small modifications or big to the guidance. And so looking ahead, as this pilot wraps up, we intend to release version 1.1 this summer, and that'll be based off learnings from the pilot. So whether that is modifications or clarifications to the guidance. And, you know, we really thank the companies that have been a part of this journey with us.
That's awesome. I love the collaboration angle. And I'm curious, have you had any like watershed focused collaborations, or is this just really spread out? Because it seems to me that there may even be a bigger impact if companies collaborate within the same watershed on achieving the targets.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's a great question, Dave. That's, you know, I think that's the goal. So, you know, how I like to describe the process is, in steps one and two, companies are taking more of a top-down or enterprise-down approach to kind of scan their value chain and understand where, you know, their impacts and dependencies are, and then where their target boundary or where the basic, you know, or what we call our target boundaries are. So where they would set targets across land, freshwater, ocean, and biodiversity. And then in step three, it kind of flips. And so there's a more of a bottom up, or what I'd say, basin up kind of approach. And so companies have you know, we default to local models to setting the targets. And one of the ways that we do that, we lay out basically a decision tree to work through local stakeholder consultation to kind of understand, you know, what are the appropriate models and targets to kind of set at the basin. And so, you know, I think as we develop this out, I think there's a real opportunity to facilitate like collective knowledge or collective intelligence about the science on the ground, the situation on the ground, understanding the context of the basin that I think will help enable further kind of collaboration among companies and perhaps we like to use the word collective action. The idea is hopefully to encourage or foster collective action. So where companies aren't just acting alone, you know, they're acting with other companies, local NGOs, partners, the local governments to try and move the needle on the status or the health of these basins.
Got it. That sounds like a great goal. So we talked a little earlier about the advantages of being an early mover in the space. But if you know, how can companies get involved? What actions can they take to actually get in on the program?
In addition to joining SBTN's corporate engagement program, I think what the from a freshwater perspective is considering, or for say for all, not just freshwater, but across nature, is considering to set science-based targets for nature, contributing to the development of the guidance. And so, you know, one example that we highlight in a recent paper, that communication paper we recently published on this, is, you know, for companies that already have freshwater targets, perhaps looking at science-based targets and seeing if this is like the next step in corporate water stewardship journey. Then there's I think a range of other kind of groups that can also kind of contribute to the process, whether that be researchers and academics and helping to identify, you know, the latest and greatest in our, you know, understanding and the science of this space. I think for, you know, local utilities and the public sector, you know, working with, you know, companies and identifying or contributing to the identification of local models so that, you know, we can have tighter targets in areas where we know there's an area of concern. And then there's a whole host of we call service providers that are needed here. So a lot of the companies that are a part of the pilot are working with consultants and NGO partners to help navigate the guidance. As I alluded to earlier, there's various realms and expertise that are kind of needed to get through the process. And so having various specialists and expertise, particularly in different parts of the world, to kind of help support companies through this process, I think is a huge advantage for companies. So I think there's a lot of areas where groups can engage in this process. But again, I'd say starting by joining SBTN's corporate engagement program. I think there's also a mailing list that companies can also sign up for as well. And that would be the first action that I would recommend.
Terrific. Well, Alan, you've been great today. It's been wonderful talking to you. Before we sign off, though, is there a leave behind message that you'd like to leave the listeners with?
Yes. So I'd say that taking action on water is a way to take action on nature loss, climate change, and societal well-being. The private sector has an essential role to play in taking action, and setting science-based targets is a step in addressing all three. So I'd say, in other words, while science-based targets are for nature, they're also for ourselves, business, and society.
Awesome. Great message, Alan. For those who are interested in finding out more about you and your work with World Wildlife Fund, where can they go to get that information?
Yeah, so they can go to our website, worldwildlifefund.org. Also, go to SBTN's website, sciencebasedtargetsfornature.org. And I'm on LinkedIn as well.
Awesome. Well, Alan, and thanks for pointing out the SBTN. I should have asked that as well. So thanks so much for coming on, Alan. It was great speaking with you, and I look forward to seeing how the program develops over time. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Dave.
All right. Bye now.
How awesome is Alan? What a terrific interview by Alan. I really enjoyed speaking with Alan and learning how WWF and Science Based Targets Network is assisting and developing and building out corporate water stewardship. Great work, Alan team. Can't wait to see how you tackle these challenges in the future. Well, I'd love to know what you thought about the interview. Please check out the show notes page for information and links on this episode. Just Google the Water Values Podcast. Click the first link that comes up. That's our home on the web, which Bluefield Research has generously given to us. Again, for longtime listeners, you know that Bluefield Research and the Water Values LLC are not affiliates. We are just entities that have decided to enter into a joint marketing arrangement together. And as part of that, Bluefield Research gives us a home on the web. You can email me at david.mcgimsey@dentons.com, and you can sign up for the newsletter at that landing page as well. Thank you again for tuning in, and I hope you make it a great day. Plus, I want to give a huge thank you to our terrific sponsors. Again, sponsors of the Water Values Podcast include 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, Xylem, the American Water Works Association, Black & Veatch, and 120 Water. This show would not be possible without those great companies and industry leaders. And thank you again for listening and subscribing to the Water Values Podcast. Your support's truly appreciated. In closing, please remember to keep the core message of the Water Values Podcast in mind as you go about your daily business. Water is our most valuable resource, so please join me by going out into the world and acting like it.
Listening to the Water Values Podcast. Thank you for spending some of your day with my dad and me.
Well, thank you for tuning in to the disclaimer. I'm a lawyer licensed in Indiana and Colorado, and nothing in this podcast should be taken as providing legal advice or as establishing an attorney-client relationship with you or with anyone else. Additionally, nothing in this podcast should be considered a solicitation for professional employment. I'm just a lawyer that finds water issues interesting and that believes greater public education is needed about water issues. And that includes enhancing my own education about water issues, because no one knows everything about water.